it was always part of the plan to put a brewery in, but for many years it was just a plan.
It's 100% acquisition of Green Beacon.
No, we had a chat with everybody.
Anyone would have seen this coming a mile away.
You know, the passion and the dedication to beer and brewing.
Oh, yeah. That's a super simple and direct question.
It's always fun to get to speak about beer.
Hi, I'm Brews News editor Matt Kirkegaard, and this week on Beer as a Conversation, we have something a little different. It's still a conversation, but it's a conversation introducing a new podcast we will be starting on our Brewery Pro podcasting channel. Yes, it's a crossover episode. We'll be jumping sharks before you know it. But please listen on, it is still a great discussion and everything will be explained. As Brews News has evolved, we discuss the news of the week and also the backgrounds of industry people, probing their experiences in the industry. While our core audience is people in and around the brewing business, both podcasts also have a much wider appeal, as we have learned. Very regularly, though, we get asked to tackle topics that are quite niche and also a little bit technical, or often very technical. These topics are often ones that we would really like to explore, but their content may be a little disconcerting to the regular flow of the Radio Brews News channel. That's one of the reasons we created the Brewery Pro channel as the home for content that has arguably higher value, but for a more limited audience than our general listener. So we'll be launching Brewer's Perspective. It's a podcast in which brewers will discuss topics that they feel are important in the contemporary industry. There will be two main hosts who you'll meet today, but each week they will also be joined by special guests and content experts to provide more in-depth discussions. Our first episode is titled, There's No 5-Second Rule in Brewing, and looks at brewing cleanliness and sanitation. It may not sound like the most sexy topic, but it's a very, very interesting and important one. And it also features Aaron McGarity from Ecolab. But as you'll hear when the episode drops, it's not specifically looking at chemicals, but how brewery design and planning and systems can make sure your beer is at the best that it can be and doesn't get spoiled. So that brings us to this episode of Beer as a Conversation. I wanted to introduce you to the two brewers who will be anchoring the show while having a very interesting Beer as a Conversation style conversation about the industry and where we are from the brewer's perspective. Both brewers have taken very different paths into the industry, and I think a lot of our listeners will find that of itself interesting. But I personally find them very, very valuable resources that I often turn to when I have questions, and so they are ideally placed to take on our pro podcast and take it to the next level. Brewer one is Anthony Clem, who has been a guest on Beer as a Conversation more than once. If you go back in our archives, you'll see that he spoke to us during his time at Lion discussing the very short-lived 4X Pale Ale, for which he can take no blame. But also, we spoke to him during his time as head brewer at Hemingway's in Cairns. However, he's done much more than those two jobs. He started working in the brewing industry over 20 years ago after studying chemistry at QUT. He did a couple of research and development jobs in such things as surfactants and marine paint before his first industry job working for Guinness in West Acton in London. And as you'll hear, he was working on a project to put the widget into a bottle. However, since returning from the UK, he has worked for Lion at West End in Adelaide in the laboratory and various other roles within the Lion Group, such as packaging quality, brewing team leader, brewer at Napstein and also at 4X. And they're some of the issues that we will be discussing in the Brewer's Perspective podcast. More recently, he worked as the quality brewer at 4X and the head brewer, general manager of the brewing business at Hemingway's in far north Queensland. He is a member of the quality committee for the IBA and on the judging panel for the Royal National Agricultural Show in Queensland. He recently started a business as a brewing consultant with the intent to give brewery owners the capability and insight to live their dreams of building a craft brewery, creating consistently great quality craft beer. The second host is Marcus Cox. He recently returned from America and was hired by Newstead Brewing in January 2021 to add some fundamental quality structures to that business, but he quickly rose to become the head brewer in March. His career as a brewer commenced at Victorian microbrewery Three Ravens back in 2003, with next to no experience, as you'll hear him admit. But he quickly positioned the brewery as a leader in the second wave of microbrewers in this country. He was part of the founding team at Thunder Road Brewing in Victoria. At the commencement of that position, he had the opportunity to design, install and commission the Thunder Road Brunswick site. In 2014, that brewery opened and entered its first beers in the Australian International Beer Awards, and they were awarded Best Medium-Sized Brewery in Australia. In August 2016, he relocated to Pittsburgh, where he became head brewer at the soon-to-be-established Mindful Brewing Company. During his time in the US, he also helped to re-establish and become vice president of the local Master Brewers Association of America chapter. He's been a frequent flyer to Japan as a judge. He's the first Australian to judge at the European Beer Star Awards in Munich, and he's been a 14-year member of the IBD. So they're the hosts of the Brewer's Perspective podcast, both very interesting guys, both willing to express an opinion, and both very quality and precision focused in their approach. And they are the guests on this great conversation about the state of beer and brewing. I hope you enjoy it and find it as interesting as I did. Marcus Cox, Anthony Clem, welcome to Beer is a Conversation / Brewer's Perspective.
Good morning, Matt.
Good morning.
Marcus, we were just very quickly talking off mic that you're the first time on Beer is a Conversation. Anthony's had a couple of appearances, so we might start with you. How did you get into the brewing industry? I know that in my intro I've given your bio, but you know, tell us a little bit how you actually came to be a brewer.
I didn't really take the homebrew route, so there's probably a deviation there. It's long enough ago that people that weren't formally qualified could still get gigs as brewers. I was working in hospitality.
To be fair, you can still do that now, but one of the things that we're going to talk about on a brewer's perspective is whether that's still the safest route to do it in the very competitive environment. So, but anyway, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Back in the early 2000s, it was...
it was safe. It was the only way.
It was the only way.
Yeah.
So I was definitely part of that. I was working in hospitality, and one of the barflies at a pub I was working at, I was a bar manager.
Do we want to name check that? Is it still around?
The Peacock Inn Hotel.
Okay.
In Melbourne, in Northcote. First venue in the area to have Coopers on tap. And it was such early days that it was, if you don't like the beer, it was money back.
Okay, wow.
And this is, you know, 2000, 2002 I'm talking about.
So 130 years into Coopers, they still had to offer them.
That was my personal guarantee.
Okay.
Yeah, we had to hit our rebates, so.
I'm just making a note that that's another thing we can talk about. But so what saw you jump the bar and go into the brewery?
I did do a little bit of home brewing, but it wasn't very serious. And one of the barflies was kind of like a drinking buddy and a mentor.
Do we want to name him?
He's probably long past, to be honest.
Okay.
Like a proper 70-year-old barfly.
Right.
He was friends with the guys at Three Ravens, and they at that stage had their informal invite-only little bar downstairs under the engineering company that owned it.
Yep.
And he invited me down there for a beer, and it was very informal. There was no expectation. I hit it off with the guys, and I think within 2 weeks we were talking about when do you want to start work.
Because they were engineers who were brewing themselves at that stage. They bought the brewery because it was going to close. Is that?
No, if it was going to close as a plasma factory or something. I think actually the original tanks were for bovine growth hormone. it was more an option.
There was good CIP.
You'd hope so.
Very good clean.
So it was very much coming off a very low base in terms of experience on my part, being zero. Getting the gig pretty quickly, I was just the right side of 30, so there was, you know, a perfect time for a career change. They hired me on future promise more than reality, and the extension of that was the second or third day. I'd been also one of Mountain Goat's first customers at that same pub, just for package. Draft Mountain Goat back then was a dream. So I knew those guys through the sales routes. So I spoke to Dave, and the second day I worked at Three Ravens, I actually spent it at Mountain Goat getting the idiot's guide to how to run a brewery. So after 4 or 5 hours down there, they sent me on my way with some beers, and that was the tuition.
Coming at it from that background, which is one of the things we'll be talking about over this series, is
were you able to make good beer from the start? And, you know, did you make a lot of mistakes and that was your very hidden in those days learnings?
Could have been more hidden. So those guys were making beer by themselves. So the engineering company was under the guidance of Ben Patterson. He was the head process engineer at the time. They were getting busier and busier, mainly with work up in Queensland. Mm-hmm. With oil and gas really starting to take off back then. They wanted to keep that side project working. So, you know, I was working with a process engineer and a team of other engineers. And if I wanted to fix or change some pipe work, we had a pipe draftsperson on staff. It was, and they were happy to let me run for 6 or 12 months, figuring it couldn't get any worse. Until I got the traction to actually start to make some improvements.
And how did you learn? How did you sort of self-improve in that environment?
That's very much my model. I just look at things going around and around and around, and after 4 or 5 times, I know how they work within reason, and I can offer improvements. One of the best decisions I ever made was to get somebody that had marginally more experience than me on board. So Matt Inchley, who's now a KJU, joined pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
And he performed most of the brewing activities, and I stepped back to be more of the brewery manager. So I had even more latitude to teach myself how to brew and about the industry.
And where did you go to learn? Because that was still very early days of, you know, sort of internet online availability of information.
This is all on the job. This is all working with the engineers, some short courses. I got to know Pete Aldred pretty well, which came was very handy later on. That was it. Yeah, as you said, the internet didn't really exist as the tool it does now.
So you've never done formal study? Because I know you've worked for the Master Brewers Association of America and things. Have you ever done any formal study?
Not to any anything above a certificate level.
Okay. You did go on to work for Thunder Road, and you were part of the team that set up that brewery, which for a lot of craft people, they might be, you know, there are views. It's a brewery that is polarizing in the purist community, but it's fair to say that Philip is who founded it is fastidious, and you would have been put through your paces,
put through the ringer,
satisfying him that you could do quality both install procedure and beer.
Yeah, that was, yeah, I managed to spend six and a half years at Three Ravens. So it was a very different Marcus that walked out the door to the one that walked in.
Yep.
So relatively mature. We'd done a lot of contract manufacture at Holgate. I hung out with the VAMI guys at that time. The mm-hmm. Victorian Association of Microbreweries was kind of around. So I had a much better industry perspective. We were starting, Three Ravens was starting to sell up as far as Brisbane, all the way down around the coast in Victoria. I also managed to not be hired by Philip, so thinking back, that probably helped. So Andrew Dunn, who was involved in the Fat Yak kind of conception,
mm-hmm.
Probably more from the brand side than anything, was the leader of the team, and he hired me, so I kind of snuck in under the radar. Philip had hired an American brewer, Mark Harvey Kenny.
Yep.
And they were looking for somebody that would be complementary to him, so... I didn't have to deal with Philip in the first month, and I was kind of on the payroll before he realised.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice. I might bring Anthony in now, because Anthony, you came at it from a slightly different route, and without, again, like it's not a loaded description, but you studied chemistry and worked in surfactants and marine paint before getting a job with one of the... larger brewers in the UK, and came back to Australia and worked for Lion. And there are a lot of craft beer people who would be sort of saying that's an appropriate job for surfactants and marine paint. Unfairly, I might add, because you were a senior quality brewer for Lion and making some very good beers, champion beers, and then went to Hemingway's. But you came at it from a very different perspective into the industry than Marcus did. You had the science background and applied it to brewing. Is that a fair?
Yeah, pretty fair assumption, Matt. So I guess, you know, chemistry degree, you know, one of those things where, you know, growing up as a kid, I needed to figure out how everything worked, and chemistry was sort of an outlet there. I guess when I left university, didn't really have much of an idea of what I wanted to do, but R&D was really interesting. So I did, you know, do a couple of R&D jobs, and then yeah, got the gig in when I was over in the UK. Got the gig at Guinness for like, you know, it was just a small contract, but you know, got me into the industry.
And what was that doing?
We were actually just setting up a little pilot production line, pilot packaging line. They were trying to put Guinness in bottles at that stage, and they developed like this rocket widget thing for the bottles that sat in the neck of the bottle and you know, pushed nitrogen into the top of the beer when you opened it. So it was just setting that up, and they just wanted, you know, scientists. It was like a bad joke. It was like two Australians, South African and a Frenchman, and you know, we're all working together on this little Guinness project that they wanted in their R&D facility at Acton there. So,
and did that ever see the light of day? Because I don't remember it.
It did, but I think it was only very, very brief. They were like 330ml bottles, and they did have the rocket widget, and they did have a full-sleeved, so they looked nice and black, and they had the creamy head on the top, but I don't think it ever showed any longevity.
Okay.
Unfortunately, they invested a lot of money, and we had a great time setting it all up and getting involved. But yeah, I don't know how successful in the end it was.
Had you brewed before that? Like, had you done home brewing or been involved in brewing?
Probably not a lot of home brewing. Just like Marcus as well, I dabbled. We did, you know, just a few things
every
at uni.
Every uni student does it.
Yeah, especially when you're doing a lot of process chemistry and stuff like that at uni, we were like, oh yeah, we've got to give this a go. And you know, we'd do beers and ginger beers and you know, poor uni students, just something to have a couple of tallies before you head out on the town, those types of things. But that was pretty much it. I didn't really do a lot of home brewing, and I still probably don't do a lot of home brewing, because I've always had access to kits and bits and pieces where, you know, you could do enough you know, exploration and experimental type stuff to not do it at home.
So what was it about the brewing industry that, because it sounds like you went to this Guinness job as a person with the requisite skills to take on that job, as opposed to being lured into an industry. What was it about the industry that's seen you stay there for over 20 years?
I guess, you know, you can only drink so much surfactant and paint, really. I think it's the people.
Is that a code word for hazy IPAs?
It could be. Pretty chunky hazy IPAs. No, I think it's the people within the industry. I've just spent, you know, the last 20 years meeting and working with such amazing people that are just, you know, so down to earth and genuine, and you know, all got a common interest. We've just loved great quality beer. You know, it's always been about the people, I think, and you know, in the end, sharing a great quality beer at the end of the day is just the reward. So yeah, that's why I've stayed.
Well, one of the reasons that I was interested in working with both of you and all of the guests that we're going to be having on is the different approaches, your different entries into the industry, but then you're two people who I learn a lot because of your focus on the technical side of brewing and, you know, the quality side of brewing and, you know, your views on that. So I'll start with this question. With both of you coming into the industry with such different backgrounds, what do you think is more important, the art of brewing or the science of brewing?
When I think about the art of brewing, it gets boring pretty quick, so I'm probably going to lean towards the technical side. But
how do you mean boring?
Well, it becomes technical. So that you know, wizard world of brewing and all the hopes and dreams of everybody fade pretty quickly. And the first thing I think of is, what am I trying to make? How much money have I got? Who's going to drink it? What does it have to look like? Does it ascribe to a style guideline? So for me, it's almost 100% technical.
Mm-hmm.
The dream of the beer normally comes from the marketing department, and they have a lot of ideas that never make sense. And it's up to you to probably pick those that are viable as a brewer. But yeah, definitely technical brewing is for me pretty much the whole thing.
How does that figure into the business? Because that's the thing, as we've discovered, well, as I've observed, you can't divorce the story and the marketing and the dream and all of that. That has to be infused in the consumer's mind.
Yeah.
But does that sit in the bottle of the beer, or does it sit on the label of the beer?
It depends where that bottle sits or that can sits. That's one of the things. So who the market is and where it ends up being sold. For the most part, it's on the outside. It's part of the person that's drinking it. So that brand story and that identity set flows through there. But there's a point where the liquid has to be what it says on the can, what you thought it was going to be, has to go to the right person, has to have cost the right amount, has to be fashionable or not fashionable, depending on the kind of brewery you're working for. I find myself very open to working in different kinds of breweries with different expectations of the product range.
Mm-hmm.
When I was living in the States, I had to unlearn a lot of things to make hazy beers. It's a completely different mindset to what I'd been doing for 15 years. So I had to start to just compartmentalize things and take them away and saying, you know, those other 99 beers that I've been making, they're not going to work here. I need to kind of work out. And I had the latitudes I was in a brew pub situation that time to work through the first 10 or 20 hazies before I got it right.
Mm-hmm.
And then even what the prevailing logic was for how to make them isn't what I went with. So I guess that was still technical, but it was probably a little bit looser because the concept wasn't necessarily built off a solid technical base.
Anthony, how about you? Science or magic?
I think you know the answer.
Well, why?
No, I see the magic and the art being in the brand and the creativity of putting recipes together that are going to appeal to people. But for me, it's the fundamentals of the technical side of brewing that you need to get right in order to provide that trust to the consumer.
Mm.
So the brand is providing a level of trust to the consumer, and behind it, in my opinion, should be a very technical and very process-driven process where you're consistently creating that flavour profile that you're trying to achieve and that the customers and consumers are wanting. So when they go pick up a can or go to their local, that they're trusting that is what they're going to get when they ask for that. So, for me, it's a lot about the science, and that's my sort of background with the IBD study I've done as well as all the chemistry. But I think those fundamentals are what make up great and consistent quality beer.
With both of you having worked in the industry for, two decades, you've essentially been involved. I regard the modern craft beer movement as really starting in 2000 with this Little Creatures, which really popularised it. There were breweries, in the 80s and the 90s. In the late 90s, we started to see the early flowerings, but it was really Little Creatures for me that brewers people were inspired into brewing. And so 21 years of craft beer in Australia, we've seen such a rapid evolution of the attitudes to it. In the early 2000s, it was the craft beer revolution and we're making something different, malt, water, hops and yeast. And as we've seen business models, we've seen what's acceptable within craft change. We've seen so many changes in attitude. Where do you both think that we are sitting, in the evolution of craft beer? Have we almost closed the circle back to where it was 20 years ago? Or, Anthony, where is the craft beer industry at the moment?
I think it's certainly moved away from the purest approach where it was, malt, hops, yeast and water.
I'm glad you could name those four key ingredients.
Yeah, look, if I couldn't, there'd be a bit of a worry. No, it's certainly moved away from that in that, the guys are being a lot more creative in the way they put beers together, and to me it seems like it's rapidly changing all the time. We're not, we're introducing new beer styles, and we're not looking back at the old beer styles. Where the brewers are really looking to create something different for their consumers. So, it's really interesting and exciting times in that you can get lots of different flavours when you're cracking open a beer. But, I do see that we are having, some fundamental quality issues still that, it's not something we really want to see, going forward, because consumers will then potentially go back to something they know rather than try something new. But yeah, interesting times. We seem to be adding lots of different things rather than the fundamentals. But you know, and that can be good and can be bad.
And I might come back to that, particularly with reference to Lion. But Marcus, how about you? Because you know, we've seen craft beer, one of the foundational styles of craft beer in the early 2000s was the IPA. And there was that romanticized story of that this is a beer that was brewed to send. And it was really borrowing a 200-year-old story and trying to legitimize this thing that was had no semblance into the original IPAs. But it was a lovely story that sold the vision of craft beer. Is that a fair...
Very much so.
Okay.
Yeah, and it was summed up for me once when I was visiting the UK, and I jumped on the train and went to Burton-on-Trent to visit.
Yeah.
And there's nothing there.
Well, not Ed, Pete Brown's Hops and Glory is a tremendous, you know, recounting of the IPA story and selling the vision and the romance of it, but then the...
You can't drink the tap water, and there's one brewery and it's Bass, and they have a kind of... down in Victoria, we have a Sovereign Hill where they have the guys made out of straw that are animated by clockwork. It wasn't what I was expecting. It was incredibly flat. You could still see the train lines and understand the industry that had taken place there.
Yeah.
But it was a moment in time, and that moment's changed.
But we're seeing that even with some of the, you know, inverted commas, sour styles, you know, where people are saying this is a Berliner Weiss or this is a, you know, a traditional style, when it, just because it's got lacto in and it's been soured, you know, the pH has been reduced, but then that's about the only touch point with some of those traditional styles, and yet we still feel the need to weave this narrative around something that is a modern invention.
Well, from a winning awards point of view, if it fits the style guidelines, you call it whatever you have to call it to win. Yeah. If a supermarket's looking for a particular subset in a category, then you can convince them that's what you've made. Just to go back quickly to the IPA,
yep. There
was a moment in time when, you know, looking from that 1850s period all the way through, where the hopping waned based on availability and cost, and then at that period you're describing, the early 2000s, it went nuclear. And once something's gone nuclear and you're left in the remnants, now the pursuit is lower bitterness.
Mm.
And where it was 60, 80, 100 IBU numbers going around just a few years ago, now you're more likely to find a lead IPA brand sitting at 20, 30 or 40. Mm. And it's more about the aromatics of the hops than the bitterness. The mineralic profile is less important. The colour's back to very, very pale generally. It's a very blurry situation, but yeah, with IPA specifically, it blew up and then it was reborn.
Without getting too philosophical, are modern IPAs still IPAs in that understanding that IPAs were hop-driven, bitter, you know, beers?
That was a moment in time, and you know, as Pete Brown's book and Mitch Steele's book have referenced, that was a very small window. It was the result of, you know, transport meeting industrialization and having access to those particular materials and particular purposes associated with that at the time. It hasn't been like that for a very long time. So the idea that things are constantly changing is very interesting. But as I said, instead of the rationale being, I guess as brewers now, we have access to everything. So, or at least we think we do. So a lot of the decisions, you know, you have this idea that I'm in the candy store and I can make beers with whatever I want. I don't mean just necessarily crazy things, but hop varieties and malt varieties. You're not tied into the stuff that got grown down the road. Like you would have been in particular periods, and generally speaking, it's not particularly efficient to ship water. So most countries and cities and zones tend to have their own beer manufacturing. So trying to bring those styles to that centralized manufacturing in one particular area is probably the target, just for shipping and logistics. And everything can go on a ship now and get there as a grain instead of get there as a beer.
It's a little bit naive to suggest this, but is that... You know, should we be using more local ingredients to have a distinctly Australian style? I mean, Australia grows hops. We, you know, one of the largest barley growers in the world. And yet you've got brewers importing hops and, you know, floor malted, you know, English malts, and to try and replicate styles. Should we be using Australian ingredients and seeing what we can create with that, both from a national perspective, but then also in terms of the, you know, we talk about sustainability, and so many brewers talk about, you know, putting solar panels on the roof to lower their carbon footprint. Should we just be not shipping dry ingredients around the world, do you think?
It's very challenging. I found myself straddling the midpoint where you use enough of the local stuff to kind of build the beer, and then for the nuance of the flavour, you bring in what you need to do that. Again, with this requirement of every brewery to make every style of beer, at least in theory, it makes, in particular in Australia, where the traditional style beers have fallen away and nobody really has any points of reference for them. I've had the pleasure of resuscitating beers from 100-year-old books before.
Thunder Road.
Correct.
Yeah, Phillips said, interest in history, there was some really interesting stuff that was done there.
And we, you know, we had the brewer's notes from the side panel of the brew log. It was an amazing set of documents. And we made those beers with the permission of his family. It wasn't particularly good. So, you know, it got us the tap at Young & Jackson's in the middle of Melbourne, because nobody else could offer that beer. And the ye olde thing was very much the selling point.
And it was a novelty.
And it was very much a novelty. And that was all Australian malt. We took grain and made our own amber malt at the bakery next door. We used predominantly not particularly sexy Australian hops and some UK stuff that was very old. As you said, a novelty. We don't have the brewing tradition here. Is, you know, from the consolidation period, it's all lager beers.
Yep.
There are three probably unique yeast strains that smaller brewers maybe don't use, which would be something to use if you wanted to. Codename Yeast A or Yeast B, whatever they call them, in the big breweries. Without that history here, I think it's very hard to have that lineage. And that coupled with the demands that every brewery makes every style of beer, you're kind of stuck.
How much of recreating an old beer style is, you know, one of those tropes, you know, that it's attention getting, it's interesting, you've got a story behind it, but as you said, they're not necessarily going to sell outside of that one-off novelty factor. How much do you think that some of the styles that are going through a upswing at the moment are just modern equivalents of that, where they're not recreations of historical styles.
Historical as well, yes.
But they are just a blip because they're momentarily interesting, but not very good.
Some of them are smaller blips than others.
Yeah.
And brewed IPA is obviously the scapegoat for this, you know, that aspect of the conversation.
I'm disappointed that brewed IPA didn't. I actually thought it should have had legs.
I'm a big fan, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, talking about the hazy beers, there's an incredible diversity amongst those. As I said, they're technically challenging to make. They're different to make to every other style of beer. They're one of those things that developed organically in a region, and then it went through the kind of homebrewing level of certification with the BJCP style guidelines, and then obviously more recently became part of the general, you know, formal professional brewers style guideline set through the Brewers Association. That kind of stuff's a little bit more of a blip. It'll probably be rationalised. I thought the exploding can situation might have accelerated that move a little bit.
No, because it's your fault as a consumer because you haven't refrigerated your beer.
And, you know, the carbonated re-fermenting milk model is often cited. Again, when you sit down from the brewing point of view and you say, okay, I've been tasked to make this type of beer, and you write the brief for the beer, if you are going to make something that's likely to explode, you try and make it a small explosion. You try and limit the area of impact. And, you know, these are the things you tick off when you're defining a product's, or its definition, when you're making the definition of a product.
Up. Okay. We're going to see beer cans with little Vents. Pressure valves. Yes, like
pressure relief valve on the top of your beer can.
I'm assuming that when the first person came up with the idea of champagne, they had some packaging issues. And then they moved on to that particular packaging model that stuck around for a couple hundred years.
Yeah, but they're very thick, very heavy bottles.
You're already paying $10 for a can. It's only $11 at that point.
Anthony, I'm going to step back to the question I was going to ask you because, you know, looking at the malt, water, hops and yeast, I think it was 2008, Lion. Were you working with Lion in 2008?
Yep, yeah.
So when they developed the natural beer promise, that again was very early days of craft. Interest was, you could sort of see the writing on the wall for mainstream beer, and they were trying to not craftify beer, but counter some of those perceptions, some of the promise that craft beer had about, you know, being better and purer and things like that. And so Lion came up with this natural beer promise where they took as much as possible tetra hops out of beers. You know, they only used five ingredients and they were open about sugar, but, you know, talking about it. And Hahn Dry couldn't because it used enzymes and it was regarded as not being a natural product. It was very forward-thinking and very ahead of its time, but there must have been a little bit of, you know, from a brewer's perspective, who would have been in seeing some of those decisions and feeling the negativity that craft brewers were pointing to these soulless big brewers. When you see what some craft brewers are willing to do now, there must be, you know, a part of 2008 Anthony that's face palming himself at how much the industry's changed.
I do vaguely remember copping a fair bit of crap about, you know, some of the gear that we used to add as big brewers to beers to, you know, make sure that maybe head retention or, you know, something like that is, you know, is kept at a premium and the beer looks fantastic and in the glass.
It was taken out of 4X Gold. Absolutely. And it wouldn't retain its head because the tetra hops was important with a beer of that character in being foam positive.
Absolutely. I mean, a small amount of tetra hop, and there was only about 5 ppm, I think, in that beer, but that alone was enough to give it, you know, extremely good head retention. And so when you do pour it across the bar in a glass, it looks fantastic. And to achieve the same level of head retention, you have to go to a lot of, you have to do a lot of different things to ensure that you do that without head, you know, without adding tetra hop. So, you know, in a very large brewery that is very heavily automated, that's quite difficult to achieve in a very short period of time. So overnight we were asked to just remove, you know, all the things that make it look look fantastic and do something different. So that was really challenging, but it was also very interesting in that, you know, we were doing some heavy thinking about exactly how we could modify the brew house or make some changes so that we could, you know, maybe soften the boil and, you know, increase, you know, leave foam positive proteins in solution and, you know, do lots of different things to make sure we were, you know, keeping those beers at you know, the visual that the consumer was expecting. But in the end, that didn't happen.
But when you look at that, that was in response to this narrative and rhetoric that the craft industry was using about being better and purer and things like that. And you look at a lot of those same things now brewers are embracing for exactly the same reasons and with the same justifications that 10 years ago the industry was against.
I was absolutely shocked. I was reading an article, I can't even remember what magazine it was in, and a brewer was describing how they were adding tetra hop, and they were a craft brewer. And so I'm like, hang on a minute.
Oh, brewed IPA using enzymes.
Yeah, brewed IPA using the same enzymes yeah. that Hahn Super Dry uses to produce low carbon. And, you know, pretty much the same as what the US guys were doing for all their low carb beers as well. So I think it comes down to, you know, there's a fair bit of creativity out there and it's availability of raw materials as well. So if everyone's got that availability of those raw materials, then, you know, someone's eventually going to go, oh, well, what happens if we do this?
Is everything fair game these days? Is there anything that's
not craft?
I get
the impression that everything is fair game at the moment.
Marcus? Because I know you laugh whenever I say at the moment or that we're in a post-craft world.
And it's, post-craft. I can definitely feel that. One of the kind of anomalies with me is I started my brewing career at Three Ravens working for chemical engineers. So they were always very open to do whatever was needed. It was normally in the scheme of us fixing process defects like head retention. We would add a head retention additive because we'd identified a problem and we gave it the big Band-Aid. And we tried to wean ourselves off that over time. So that was very much the way they thought, and that's the way they taught me to think.
So is craft a lie? Like the idea of craft, was it a lie that we willingly told ourselves?
Well, no. I mean, you know, once a week something blew up and we all got covered in shit and, and your deliveries were late because the $5,000 van broke down, and that's craft.
Yeah. Well, that's punk.
That's somewhere in between.
Well, was craft the punk of its day, where it had a very brief meaning, you know, but then very quickly became something else?
Yes.
Okay.
I could definitely see that happening. There was a moment in time, and then that was distorted very quickly. And, you know, things like Napstein, for me, completely threw that up that time ago. Being out at that brewery, drinking that beer from at the winery.
Anthony, you were a brewer at Napstein.
Yeah, I was a brewer at Napstein
drinking
for a couple of years.
That one keg of beer that was there, that was the best tasting beer in the world, the only place you could get it. I think the brewer that was there at the time when I visited had to pull a delivery off a truck, and he left me alone with the tap.
That was
a pretty good trade-off. Yeah. but, you know, that obviously being a line company at that stage and having that ownership, making this high level of craft beer and with making a lager interesting was mind-blowing.
You know, one of my views that I've espoused in listening to brewers on both sides of the argument is something like pasteurization, which still hasn't been adopted by many craft breweries in their own venues. Some of them are doing it when they're producing elsewhere because their contract partner pasteurizes. But there's still a consumer rejection of it. There's still a lot of brewers who want to passionately argue against a tool like pasteurization as being not craft. And I've got this theory that anything that small brewers can't do because they can't afford to, or they don't have the resources, or they don't have the means to, is what's not craft. As soon as they can do something, or as soon as they see a benefit of it, that slides very, very quickly. You know, I'm throwing that out there as my controversial opinion. Maybe not the only one.
Well,
so
pasteurization is a scale. So a lot of those negative associations are made from a time when high adjunct beers that were expected to have a year and a half shelf life were pasteurized to hell. The base beer was commodity driven, so it wasn't necessarily the fanciest ingredients, and the pasteurization level was thought up to 10 or 11. It's just in terms of the volume scale. Negative associations, probably with the US leading and smaller, maybe regional city based European breweries, the cost of pasteurization's come down radically. You still need a very clean beer, often with low levels or control level of solids, very low DO, dissolved oxygen, to get a good pasteurization. And if you're pasteurizing at the lower end of the spectrum, the flavor impacts off a good base beer are effectively zero. Some places will pasteurize and then bottle condition after that, for example. There's a lot of different combinations. But the price of pasteurizers at the moment, it's very affordable for a 1 million, 2 million litre brewery.
Mm-hmm. And do you think as we see more breweries grow through that, you know, we are seeing breweries grow and reach that 1-2 million litre mark, do you think we will see more of them start to adopt?
If something's going to have to give. You can't just keep being reactionary with product recalls forever. Sterile filtration's cost inhibitive still. The consumables aren't great. The wastage isn't great. Coming to the need for a broader market physically and type of outlet. To get in every store, you need to go all the way to Perth. You're probably going to have to do something magical like pasteurize to make the beer stable from there, or as some other breweries do coming the other way, refrigerated supply chain. But you need to be pretty big and have a lot of trucks on the road to make that viable.
I agree. I think it's going to become more and more commercial, and you know, as people are distributing further and wider from their local areas, the expectation is that, you know, in order to maintain your brand, you know, you're placing a lot of trust in a brand name, and people expect good things from it. If you're sending it all around the country and it's not stable, then, you know, the variability in flavour profile is going to be significant. So that's the idea of, you know, pasteurisation. You essentially make sure that you've got a stable beer that can get to consumers a little bit further away than your local area. So I think as your distribution of these smaller brands increases, then they're going to need to consider what they need to do to stabilise their beers and maintain that consistency of flavour profile.
Now, just looking at the time, probably need to wind this introduction up. Brewer's Perspective, Brews News has been broadcasting or podcasting for over a decade now, looking at sort of discussing the news and some of the industry-wide things. This podcast is going to be much more technical, looking at a brewer's perspective over the industry and looking at things. What do you guys, you know, you guys are giving up your time to host and create this podcast. What are you guys hoping to do with the Brewer's Perspective?
I think it's basically support the industry I love. I've been in the industry for a long time and I intend to stay here for a lot longer, and I really want to support the industry that I love so much and the people in it as well. So I think we're in a time where, you know, I know education is important, and there's not a lot in the way of education going around for brewers. I know we've got, you know, the TAFE course is fantastic. We've got the IBD qualifications, but on the whole, it's, you know, learn on the job, which is great. But you know, it can also introduce some other normalizations that are just considered, oh well, that's what we do.
Mm.
So you know, I think my aim is to just increase the level of education and support we offer to the people in the industry wanting to make great quality and consistent great quality great craft beer.
Marcus?
Yeah, look, something similar, being personally mature in the industry, very much a fan of giving something back. But also the extension of that is you can't really brew by Googling or brew by Reddit. And it was something I saw when I was living in the US, but also working now at Newstead with a young team. There's a lot of stuff you forget people don't know. A lot of fundamentals. The industry's expanded at such a quick rate. A lot of people have migrated into jobs that maybe they're not ready for. They're a year or two out and they're in those positions already. So just, obviously, Anthony and I are very open about our backgrounds, and probably from what you've just heard about pasteurization, we you know, like particular things. We like stable beers and beers to be defined. And that's, you know, purely by coincidence what we're both into. But the idea that just filling those gaps in knowledge, giving people access, not this, you know, an independent source of information, hopefully we can provide, and it's going to be topic specific.
And you know, obviously we're not trying to be a diploma course in beer, we're not trying to be a Master Brewers course, but as Brews News does, we like to ventilate issues and get a variety of perspectives about it. But we'll certainly be working with, you know, all of the formalised training providers to encourage people to go through them. But it's, from my perspective as a editor of Brews News, it's getting that variety of discussions, because there is no one size fits all solution to anything in the industry, as we've already talked about, and hearing with you both and the guests that we've planned coming from very different perspectives in the industry, raising some of those topics that people can then go and ask the questions themselves.
Yeah, I'm hoping we have lots of practical discussions, you know, lots of, you know, little gems hopefully that are in there that guys that are listening, brewers that are listening, can go, oh yeah, oh, I'll look into that.
And neither of you are selling anything. Yeah, well, sorry, no. you do consult. So yes, and there will be a link to that, but you don't sell anything. So it's yeah, trying to be as non-commercial as you can and still run a business. But that's the line that Brews News always wants to walk. So yeah, so hopefully there'll be some interesting opinions raised. So Anthony, Marcus, thank you very much for joining me for this Beer as a Conversation, very first episode of A Brewer's Perspective, and look forward to our very first chat, which is going to be looking at chemicals in the brewing industry. Yeah, cleaning chemicals. And that was your suggestion, Anthony.
Yeah, it should be an interesting one. I think it is. It's one of those things that has been a little bit normalised. You walk into breweries and you see things and go, that's not ideal. But I think everyone's like, oh, well, that's how it is.
And we'll see. So that'll be the very first episode next week on A Brewer's Perspective. Thank you both.
Thanks, Matt.
And that was Marcus Cox and Anthony Clem. As I think you'll hopefully appreciate, very wide-ranging topics there, but hopefully
regular listeners would still find that very interesting. If you'd like to find out more about the Brewery Pro podcast, which will be dropping next week, you can subscribe on your favourite podcasting platform. Just search for Brewery Pro. We'll also be starting a Brewery Pro Facebook group, just like the Radio Brews News one, specifically for feedback on that show and discussion about more technical topics. We will also be looking at doing a more business-focused one there as well. So you might want to, if you're listening to this podcast, you may well want to join that one as well. You can email us at brewersperspective@brewsnews.com.au. And as always, let us know what you think either on either the regular producer of Brews News or the Brewers Perspective at brewsnews.com.au. It will find us, and the bar blades will flow through that channel as well.